It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney. Today is our second installment of our coverage of the 8th episode of Season 11, which is Familiar. And joining me to discuss Familiar is Andrew Blaker. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Carl.
Yeah, I thought it'd be good to get into some of the, you know, the really striking elements of this episode. So we'll talk a bit about Mr. Chuckleteeth. We'll talk a bit about the Bibble Tiggles and the Demonic Hound and all that stuff. And also some of the, the townsfolk, some of the cast who made up this episode. But as we were kind of alluding to on the last podcast, it was just good, wasn't it, to have another small town case, wasn't it? It felt very quintessential X-Files, I think.
It did. Yeah, those are my favorite kind of episodes. So I was happy when I saw that this was going to be a very paint-by-numbers kind of episode.
Yeah, and it reminded me of lots of other things, you know, not just old X-Files episodes, but like also some films, you know. So I think a lot of people have compared aspects of this to It, you know, the Stephen King book turned film, also a miniseries. There was a film a couple of years ago called The Witch, and kind of the feel of this episode seemed to evoke that. And one of the characters had the surname Eggers, which is shared by the director of The Witch. So I think it's probably an explicit nod. And we had this very effective teaser, I thought. And this actually reminded me a little of, I don't know if you were, did you ever see the film The Village?
Yeah.
The M. Night Shyamalan film.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that film had very strong use of like bright colours like yellow, and I think you saw that here with the boy who was wearing a yellow coat, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great teaser. That was one of the best uses of Vancouver, I think. Just the way, I mean, just the gloomiest of days and this forest of these massive ancient trees, and it was a really great teaser.
It was, wasn't it? And I think, I mean, this is airing as episode 8, but it was filmed as episode 9 in production order, I think. So they were filming right at the end of last year. And they were getting, you know, yeah, really good mileage at the locations, I think. Yes, yeah, so let's talk a bit more about that teaser, because, you know, a child's death, obviously. So there's kind of a limit on how graphic they can get, but it's still very kind of hard-hitting, I think. Kind of evocative of the episode The Calasari, I think, which also began with a small child lured to their death. But I guess the element that's going to be remembered here is the figure of Mr. Chuckleteeth, you know. Tell me what you made of him.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that... First off, it's almost hard to believe that that would be something incorporated as a child's toy. That is a creature you can make into a doll and hand to a four-year-old is pretty mind-boggling. But, you know... It was extremely effective. I mean, I remember first seeing that character in one of the teasers with the little boy in the woods, you know, calling his name. And I mean, it was very creepy. And we see him later near the end of the episode when the murdered boy's father is trying to confront the chief in the chief's home, and Chuckleteeth's running around in what really plays like a true horror film sequence. An extremely effective and creepy character, I thought.
I think he's going to be a very memorable, character. And I saw a quote from Benjamin Van Allen, who talked about the inspiration, and he said, Mr. Chuckleteeth was actually inspired by an old British kids TV show called Jigsaw. There's a character called Mr. Nosybonk, and he kind of looks like Mr. Chuckleteeth a little bit. So that was the inspiration for me when I was writing the character. So have you seen that character, Mr.?
I have not. I want to look him up now.
Yeah, it's well worth having a search, because until you see it, you sort of imagine it couldn't be. It's actually very scary, I think. And I don't know, kids' TV. I don't know if you spend much time watching, like, children's TV, Andrew, but there's some scary stuff out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, there definitely is, and this, I mean, talking about the demonic-looking Teletubbies, what are they called in this episode?
I believe it's the Bibble Tiggles.
Bibble Tiggles.
Yeah.
Okay, well, they're, I mean, I mean, that's obviously a rip on the Teletubbies, but even worse than the Teletubbies, which I didn't think was possible, but this episode did.
Well, I think it's so effective because, you know, the episode's title is Familiar, and something like a children's TV character, I think, as a parent, they really do become part of your lives, you know, because they, you know, they're kind of on every day or most days, and children tend to select favourites, you know, really early. So, yeah, the Teletubbies, man. And I don't know, there's a kids' TV show called In the Night Garden, which this episode kind of made me think of a little bit. There's not really a direct link, but In the Night Garden, if you've ever seen it, it takes place in this, like, surreal, like, dreamscape. It's hard to explain, but, yeah, there's some weird stuff out there in kids' TV. So I thought it was very effective, you know. I think it kind of... I think there's something unsettling just below the surface of a lot of kids' TV shows. So I thought that hit the mark. And, yeah, there were some other memorable visuals in this one, weren't there? Because... you know, we had the Hellhound as well. We had, you know, that final sequence where, you know, Anna's surrounded by the circle of candles and she's trying to cast a spell, or she's trying to reverse a spell, I think. And, yeah, I think this one, I think, will be remembered perhaps primarily for its visuals. I don't know if you think that's fair.
No, I think that's very fair. I mean, you've got some striking villains, so to speak, even though they're not truly the villains. But, yeah, I mean, I think... those coupled with the great Vancouver shots that we got, I think that it just really evokes, you know, what a lot of fans remember from the earlier episodes.
Yeah, totally. And in terms of earlier episodes, I mean, it feels a lot like something like the Handy Valettes, doesn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. Were there any other episodes from the original series that this kind of reminded you of specifically?
That's the one that first comes to mind. They also toy with witchcraft in, I'm not going to pronounce it right, Syzygy, I don't know, from season three.
yeah, Syzygy, I think, Syzygy, is what I say. Yeah,
yeah, but no, Dihan Diverlets, that's, I mean, this really did feel like a companion piece to it, because there's some similar shots, I think, that the way things were framed and some of the same elements of witchcraft that you get in both episodes. And, you know, that's one of my early favorites. And I think it's great to kind of revisit those past episodes.
Yeah. And I suppose another episode, it reminded me a little of something like Chinga, you know, the small town intrigue there. There was some of that here, I think. And Chimera in season 7, you know, where that was all about kind of the corrupting effect of adultery. So is this one, really. So I think the question is, does this become its own thing, really? Or is it kind of a hybrid of familiar elements that we've seen before? And I think because of the visuals, it does become its own thing. But I can kind of see both sides of the argument, really.
Yeah, I mean, it borrows from a lot of past themes, but, you know, with over 200 episodes, you know, it's going to be real hard to come up with something completely original. you know, Followers was, the last episode was completely original, but, you know, in terms of the Monster of the Week, you're going to have a lot of borrowed elements, and hence the episode title, Familiar. But I mean, you're right. The characters, it comes down to the characters, it comes down to the visuals and the villains. And I think in this episode, you know, you got a real good... you know, case of bringing relevant issues, you know, children's programming, subliminal messaging, whatever, into, you know, into play. And I thought that was kind of a mix of the new and the old.
Yeah. And I think sometimes where I differ with other fans, I think, is I'm very, you know, comfortable when they kind of reuse elements from the past. Because I think where some people see a rehash, I sort of see variations on a theme, I think. So, like you say, any series that gets to 200 episodes and above, there were going to be familiar elements, aren't there, I think. Like you say, the casting kind of is key, isn't it? And let's talk a bit about the casting, because I thought you had a decent lineup here. And One thing I'll just mention to kick us off before we talk about some of the other people maybe is it was good to see Roger Cross. He was Officer Wentworth, the one who had kind of a bit of doubt about, you know, whether they'd got the right suspect. And, you know, he'd been in 4 episodes of the original series, including Pusher. You know, he's appeared in the series 24 as a character called Curtis Manning in that series. Got a long list of credits. But it's kind of cool when you see people of the series as used before, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's just like they did back in the early seasons filming in Vancouver, where you'd have the same actor appear in some bit parts over different seasons. And that was one of the, you know, I'm not usually good at recognizing when an actor is, you know, reappeared in the show. But in this case, I did. And I was kind of surprised at myself. But he, you're right. I mean, he's played some good characters. Now, has he played in all those episodes? I know in Pusher, he was a cop. Was he anything other than law enforcement in those episodes?
He was very similar characters every time, I think. But I don't think it was the same person, you know, turning up in all these cases. I think he kind of fit the type. But this was like the most, probably the most he's had to do on the X-Files, wasn't it? He had a couple of nice scenes, I thought.
Yeah, no, I mean, a great minor supporting character for sure. And I felt like the episode really benefited from him and several others.
Yeah, did anyone, like, stand out to you? Because I don't think anyone stood out to me, but I mean that in kind of a good way, in that they all seemed very credible, I thought. Nobody was kind of distracting from the action too much. Even the child actors, you know, were effective too, I thought, as well.
I mean, I think my favorite has to be the little boy at the beginning. The fact that the actor's actually only 4 years old, and that he could, you know, play that role and take the direction and do what he needed to do, I thought was really, really something. I also felt that I don't know the actor's name, but the chief, whose daughter was the second victim, I felt like he did a good job, because I really did think he was the man responsible. And he kind of, you know, behaves in such a way that would indicate that. But then you see that he's really just kind of a pawn in the game as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I saw quite a few fans responding to the episode like immediately afterwards, and they were sort of saying that they kind of had everything figured out very early on. And I was sort of thinking, wow, I didn't, you know. But what about the plot mechanics then? So it had you guessing all the way through, or what?
I would say it. Well, yes, I was guessing all the way through. I actually had to go on our Facebook group and kind of get some clarification, because, I mean, Mulder sees the Hellhound, and then the boy's father encounters Mr. Chuckleteeth in the house. And I knew that, you know, there was a curse in the town, but exactly, you know, was that a mirage of sorts? I was a little confused on that. So I got some clarification on that, but yes, I guess you could say I did keep guessing.
No, I mean, I thought there were some elements that I wasn't 100% clear on as well, you know, because like in the teaser, the woman takes a phone call and we discover later it's from the police chief, and she's trying to end the affair, I think. Mm-hmm. And then Anna kind of overhears that, and then Mr. Chuckleteeth seems to appear. So I didn't know if her stress was kind of the trigger for it, but then later on with the second child who dies, that didn't appear to be the case. You know, the evil Teletubby just kind of turned up out of the blue, it seemed. So
right.
No, I thought there were some elements that either, I mean, they may well be clear. I might just need to rewatch and piece everything together. But on first viewing, I was kind of puzzled, but it didn't bother me because I just kind of went with it, you know, because we can always rewatch and figure out what's going on, can't we?
And, you know, when I think back on the show and, you know, the episodes that I like to go back and rewatch, it's usually the ones that offer multiple interpretations, the ones that sometimes aren't clear, that you have to go back and kind of see, okay, what was the sequence of events, you know, things that you miss even after a few viewings. I think that's what keeps you coming back to the show. And that was one good thing about this episode. I thought that you could revisit it and probably see something different each time.
Yeah. And just before we leave the subject of like the cast, one thing I've really liked about season 11 is there hasn't really, I don't think, been any like stunt casting, you know, where they're using kind of big names, with the possible exception of like Brian Husky in the Darren Morgan episode, you know, where he's quite well known from series like Veep and so on. And it's one thing I felt the series got away from when they left Vancouver originally. When they went to LA for season 6, you know, some of the names you start to see in the series become a bit bigger, you know, more well-known. And I felt the series kind of lost something. So I do like that, particularly in season 11, they've got back to the way that used to be, I think, where, you know, these characters, these actors just seem to kind of try to blend into the roles, you know?
Right. No, I think that's a testament to the actors as well as, you know, kind of, you know, I'm sure they're finding Vancouver talent just as they did in the early years here. You know, actors who you probably won't recognize immediately unless you've, you know, got an excellent memory. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think it, you know, there have certainly been some good celebrity guests, but I think to really become a character, it helps if, you know, you don't have as well known of an actor.
Yeah, because in season 10, it was kind of mixed on that front, wasn't it? Because you had people like Joel McHale as Tad O'Malley and Kumail Nanjiani in the Weremonster episode. So, all right, let's talk a little about, you know, some of the themes here. You know, this kind of witch hunt aspect, you know, all these things, mob justice, the presumption of innocence. I mean, there is the interesting suggestion Mulder seems to make towards the end of the episode, you know, where he seems to wonder if the kind of mass hysteria that breaks out was part of a spell or not, or whether it was kind of naturally occurring. I can't remember the exact wording, sadly, but yeah, I mean, it's a delicate subject. Let's get into it a little bit, you know, because it's very timely, isn't it? And Benjamin Van Allen has kind of talked a little bit about, you know, this being something you see online all the time, particularly on Twitter, I think. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, the rush to judgment, it can't be a good thing, I don't think.
No, I mean, and it's very timely. You get the hesitation with even talking about this. I will always say it's an excellent point. And I think as a society at large, we do rush to judgment on anything. I mean, and I think that that's a result of living in a 24/7 media world, I think, where, you know, you want to know everything immediately and be the first to break stories and, you know, facts sometimes get a little obscured. And that's always been the case. I mean, that's not new. That's not, you know, it's particularly acute, I think, right now, but it's not new. And so I think that the episode does a good job of kind of bringing up, you know, some of that. And I did like the idea of, you know, seeing the angry mob, the angry townspeople, almost as though they are in a way cursed as well, that their behavior is somehow beyond them and they're being somehow compelled to this rush to judgment, this extreme hostility and rage that, you know, I thought that mob scene towards the, well, it's probably more about the middle of the episode, that was really well done. And it was genuinely shocking, I think. And I think that that's a testament to the writing of the episode as well as the directing.
Yeah, you mean the moment where he gets shot dead?
Yeah.
Very shocking, I thought. I didn't see that coming, really.
No.
And I can't really decide whether that's kind of, you know, the fact that you have the sex offender kind of murdered by this, well, it's by the policeman, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Is it kind of labouring the point too much? But, I mean, like you say, there's no getting away from the fact I felt it was, you know, it took me aback, really.
Yeah, no, I mean, I thought it was a good... I definitely didn't see it coming. I think a lot, I was reading some of the tweets online. I think a lot of people didn't either. And, you know, I think that that's just testament to, again, this whole mob mentality thing of unpredictable behavior that's come up in the town. And I thought it was a real subtle nod to that.
Yeah. Cause I mean, it's timely in a lot of ways, but I mean, you can apply it to like television fandom, can't you, I guess?
Yeah, you can. Yes, you can.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's sometimes easy to get clouded on it and assume it's more of a problem than it is.
Right.
Or is it? I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, I do think if we're speaking about X-Files fandom, I mean, I do think that there is a lot of passion on this front. You know, we're presented with very well what might be the last season, what definitely looks to be the last season with Gillian Anderson, who has, I mean, you know, you'll remember season 8 and 9 when Duchovny was gone, she was the series lead. She has been with the series consistently from the beginning. So to imagine the show without her is not something a lot of fans want to do. And, you know, we're very protective of the show and the characters. And I do think that there's the tendency to kind of see this almost as more than a show, you know? as we have for so many years. So I think in certain corners of the fandom there is a lot of anger. And, you know, it could be argued through social media, maybe a little bit of mob mentality on the elements of these episodes that we don't agree with, or, you know, particularly with regards to the myth arc, things that we would like to see different.
I think maybe the key phrase there is, like, certain corners, isn't it? Because, like, none of us ever see the, like, totality of fan responses, do we? So I think sometimes it's a case of, like, the loudest voices make themselves heard the most, don't they? And that isn't always a good thing.
Right, exactly.
All right, so, I mean, I'll tell you finally, I was half expecting, because I don't see the episode until about a day after they've aired in the US, and I do my best to avoid any online response, you know, before I see it. And I wondered if there'd be some criticism online about the fact it boils down to, you know, a scorned woman has kind of been, you know, inadvertently the cause of this. But I haven't really seen anybody critiquing that too much. I don't know if you have.
No, I haven't. And to be honest, I hadn't really considered that element. But no, I mean, that's a valid point. I don't think anyone's picked up too much on that.
I didn't really see it as a problem myself. I just wondered if that would be how some people would take it, you know. I always kind of try and second guess what the response to the episode is going to be before I, like, log on and have a look.
And, you know, especially with pretty widespread fan reaction to the revelation we got from the Cigarette Smoky Man in the premiere episode this season, you know, that provoked a lot of ire, and I think that you would have to literally live underneath a rock to not know that. And I think that got to the cast and the characters. I don't know if this is relevant, but I was at the X-Fest fan convention in Illinois over the weekend, last weekend, and William B. Davis was one of many stars that were there. And he was asked a question, I can't remember exactly what it was, about twists, you know, for his character as well as the show. And of course, the revelation at the end of My Struggle 3 was brought up. And, you know, there was, you know, it was very good natured, but there was booing in the audience. There was, you know, and he seemed to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, okay, well, this has provoked a lot of fan reaction. He seemed a little surprised that it had. And, you know, basically said, you know, stay with the show, see till the end, you know, the episode, the finale will, you know, make things clear. So I think that it's hard to get away from that, especially in today's world. And yeah.
Yeah, no worries, Andrew. I mean, I think tomorrow, on tomorrow's podcast, I think we'll get into, like, the end of the series a little bit more. But mainly, I think we'll be focusing on the, you know, two first-timers in terms of on-screen writing directing credits, because we're going to talk about the writer of this episode, Benjamin Van Allen. And we're going to talk about the episode's director, Holly Dale. So, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow.
Great. Thanks, Carl.
Cool. And in the meantime, of course, everyone, you can find us on Twitter at @X_cast or on Facebook at X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group. And until next time, trust no one.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.